Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Additional support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation. From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the center. The National Humanities Center is an independent, nonprofit institute that encourages excellence in scholarship and affirms the importance of the humanities in American life.
Well, I think so, in that Assyriology is kind of on the edge of the canon, right? We're not Greece and Rome, and yet we're also third world, you know, because we're physically out there in the Middle East.
I'm a classical archaeologist. That means a special kind of classicist that works with material and visual evidence from the ancient world, and specifically from Greece, ancient Greece, and Rome.
Ancient Art and History, this week on Soundings. First, Daniel Snell of the University of Oklahoma discusses his study of economic and social history in the ancient Near East. Following that, Gloria Ferrari of Bryn Mawr College discusses image and function in the interpretation of ancient Greek vases. Dan Snell's scholarship focuses on the cuneiform tradition, covering approximately 2,500 years before the Common Era. The ancient Near East consisted of what today is known as southern Iraq, Syria, and Israel. Languages of the region included Sumerian, Akkadian, Hittite, Ugaritic, and Egyptian. Here is Dan Snell.
Well, general thesis direction, I would say that what I'm trying to do is to make accessible to a general public the fact that that we know a lot about societies and economies in that period.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not interested particularly in political history at this point.
That's a daring thing to say, is it not, to leave the politics out?
Well, we don't know that much about politics, it turns out. I mean, we know what kings want us to know.
Right.
But the kinds of texts that we have a great deal of that are not usually accessible to normal people, even who have taken ancient history courses, is texts about economics, mm-hmm. about the nitty-gritty of life. And that's not usually too affected by propaganda, what kings want you to think and so mm-hmm. on. I've got to admit, of course, that when I divide up this period, I do it politically. I mean, we talk about dynasties and so on, and I'd kind of rather not do that, and it may be that out of my study will come some new kind of chronological framework, but I feel that there is some reality to the political division, so they may not really be social and political ones.
All right, well, let me look at you wide-eyed, Dan Snell. If we leave the politics out, why should we talk about money? Why is that a starting point for ancient history?
Well, money is how people exchange goods and services, and they've been doing that for a long time, regardless of what the kings thought they should do, apparently. Mm-hmm. Now, money is actually a problem, as you may know, because for most of this period, we don't have coinage. So, they don't have...
You mean figuring out what
is
life
money?
Was worth in those days in contrast to what it's worth today? What?
Right, and how you actually went about making exchanges and paying for things.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes we assume, and it may be true for large parts of the ancient Near East, that barter was an important way of exchanging goods and services. On the other hand, from very early periods, there are things that serve as money. That are convertible into other things that you pay debts with.
Camels?
No. Camels are relatively light. Silver is one of them.
Okay.
Other kind of grain is good because it lasts over several seasons, as long as you don't get it wet,
Right.
And it looks as though many of these societies used a variety of monies in this way. That is, a variety of different things for what we regard as money.
All right. Let me ask you to be anecdotal for me, Dan Snell. Tell me about some of the characters that you deal with, particularly vivid personages or events that you go through. Do you work in those terms?
Social and economic history in general doesn't usually deal with individuals.
Mm-hmm.
We're dealing with masses of texts. However, I've got to admit that I do try to talk about what we know about specific people in circumstances. I've got, and what I do at the beginning of each sort of 500-year period is try to think, try to find some typical text or important text and dramatize it and say, you know, what factors are going into it. I have a slave sale of a woman the Middle Babylonian period, and which I'm publishing, and it doesn't say what she thinks about it, you know. Or I mean, actually, it's a delayed slave sale. It's like somebody got the money from it, and then years later, the guy shows up and says, "Okay, I want my slave now," you know. But I try to kind of tease out what she might have felt about it and how the institution looks from her point of view.
You're not writing psychobiography by any means.
Well, no, I don't think so. I mean, we don't really know those things. And yet, you know, every single text has a story behind it like that. And, you know, good Assyriology, it seems to me, does do exactly that. Maybe not so fictionally, you know, and with not quite that freedom. But you do try to figure out, you know, why are these people, I mean, to quote a famous article, who are all those people? You know,
yeah,
what are they
there.
Doing? It's turned out that they were wedding guests who had to be paid off. You know, everybody got a little trinket went home.
Uh-huh. Dan Snell, tell me about what? The stereotypes. Are there notions about the history of the ancient world, about the ancient world that you as an ancient historian find yourself particularly dedicated to addressing or breaking down?
Well, it's a question of simplicity. Are these extremely simple societies? I mean, we kind of think, because of, you know, our 19th century approach to evolution, that social evolution goes along with it, and these are simple societies, and that they're getting more complex as we go over time. I'm not so sure that's true. I wouldn't really.
They're more sophisticated than we give them credit for being.
Yeah, usually I think that's so. Although, you know, there are important things that, like the non-use of coinage, that have got to cause you to question, you know, how they function. But not using coinage doesn't mean that they're not sophisticated. Maybe they're more sophisticated, right? Because you got to know what kind of money to pay for this thing in, and
right.
Maybe there are three different things that you can choose, and. You know, I don't always know why they choose one thing or another.
Commercially, for instance, were the ancients more sophisticated than we are? I mean, look,
more
we've got the New York Stock Exchange and
now,
computers and
I
all of that.
I wouldn't say that, because there are differences in technology, right? And information sharing is one of the major things that technology gives you, the fact that you can know what the Japanese market did, you know. Mm-hmm. Now, my people in this long period do every once in a while talk about prices and prices at other places and, you know, and maybe how you might take advantage of it, or could you pick me up something because salt, because I've heard it's cheap out there or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Their information, I mean, we're seeing the way they share information, and it's likely to involve delays of weeks, you know, to get a letter. And so that's not going to be as sophisticated or as quick. And then there's a whole question about whether there are markets in the modern sense of the word. Certainly not like the Tokyo Stock Exchange. But my prejudice is that people are responding to supply and demand, that they have needs and they are trying to fulfill them, and, you know, are presumably willing to pay more when it's good is rarer.
Mm-hmm.
But that's actually controversial.
What difference will this study that you are undertaking of ancient history, will it make to a general reader? What difference will it make to what we have inherited, our legacy, our received notions of ancient history?
Well, I hope it'll make it more subtle and detailed, and that people will perceive that there are depths to all of these things. And another thing that I hope is that it may enter into debates to some extent, and maybe just obliquely, about declines and falls. You know, I mean, why do civilizations persist and why do they stop?
The sort of Paul Kennedy stuff,
right.
The rise and fall
right.
of the great powers, all of that.
Yeah, whose theory, if I may grossly simplify it, is that great powers overextend themselves, and that's why they fall. Sometimes that works in ancient Near Eastern history, but not always. And then it struck me looking at this recently that the what we really see in the falls of, say, Egypt and Mesopotamian culture is not something like that. They really persist a long time after political power is gone. And the thing to watch in the ebbing of a culture is its educational institutions, it seems to me, that people are still writing in cuneiform and still writing in Egyptian hieroglyphics to a very late period. And it's not, I mean, we sometimes say, well, what happens? Why do these things decline, it's because Alexander comes in and brings Greek culture and the Hellenists take over. But it turns out that that's very much more complex than that, and it takes a long, long time. I mean, the last datable cuneiform tablet is like 71 of our era. The last recognizable Egyptian text is supposedly 400 of our era. And that means little people are sitting there not aware that their culture is declining. And, I mean, it strikes me that when we worry about declines and falls, we're talking about, or Paul Kennedy is talking about, you know, the end of the British Empire. And yet the British Empire, though it's over, that England is over in any sensible sense. And then we worry about, you know, the Japanese buying out our industries or something. And yet, I don't think that we're facing that kind of decline and fall. I tend to tell my students that when you worry about these kinds of things, I mean, it's okay to worry about them. It's reasonable to worry about them. But the thing to watch is, you know, Americans winning Nobel Prizes. This year, we still keep doing it. And, I mean, you know, I'm not going to be that upset if we don't for a few years. But that means that our educational, that the way we pass on our written learning is continuing, you know, in the sense of, you know, the culture ending. And people not remember. I mean, it happened both to Egypt and to Mesopotamia, where people at some point looked at cuneiform tablets and hieroglyphics and said, what does that mean?
Are you a believer in such analogies, that we can learn something from these ancient societies and the shaping of our own, well, you mentioned education, our own cultural institutions, the direction of our public or foreign policy? Does that come too close to pragmatism or relevancy for you?
Oh, I don't mind relevance, but it's not likely that we're going to come away from ancient history with specific policy recommendations. You know, every once in a while, ancient historians like to be, hip and and like one of my teachers was quoted in a Supreme Court decision. You know, I mean, I think this probably ultimately pleased him. But what we are seeing is that the ancient world is a very complex world, and, you know, we can take lots of lessons away from it, and maybe the opposite of what I've just been saying could be argued too. Any text, if you look at it closely enough, has human emotion in it. One that's especially interesting because of recent events is a text at Emory University, a very tiny little pillow of clay that records from around, I think, the year 2030 BC, rations given to people who were going out as messengers, apparently, from southern Iraq, southern Mesopotamia. We're not real clear where they're going. They have kind of strange names for southern Mesopotamians, and they get a normal range of stuff, which includes some grain, some soap, apparently, to keep clean with, a little garlic to spice their foods, whatever. Well,
there's some beer in there, wasn't
there? A little
there?
Beer. Yeah. That's right. Well, hey.
Fair enough.
Well, actually, I feel that the water was probably so horrible, you know, that it was better if it was drunk as beer. You'd get less sick if you were worse.
And all of this is recorded on a tablet at Emory.
That's right.
And what did you do?
Well, I translated it a number of years ago and published it. The thing that's of interest now is that it is has been the first tablet in space.
Last November.
That's right. Uh-huh. One of the astronauts on one of these secret flights, who is an Emory alumnus, asked Emory University for something that was tiny but could be shown in their museum, that was going to be symbolic somehow of Emory.
Now, this is the oldest thing ever to go into space?
Apparently. Uh-huh. I mean, maybe they've taken some rocks. They've certainly gotten some rocks that are old. But the oldest human-made thing, I think, without any doubt.
Did they send your translation into space,
too? I don't think so, no.
Dan Snell teaches at the University of Oklahoma. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. During his recent fellowship year at the center, Dan Snell worked on an economic and social history of the ancient Near East. Soundings on Antiquity continues. My guest now is Gloria Ferrari of Bryn Mawr College. During her recent fellowship year at the National Humanities Center, Gloria Ferrari worked on a study of image and function in the interpretation of ancient Greek vases. Her scholarship combines methodological theory and visual evidence that dates from approximately 560 to 400 years before the Christian era in Greek history. Here is Gloria Ferrari.
the project is actually one that has been structured over 2 years, and this is the first of the 2 years. And ultimately, the problem that it is addressing is how to make better use of archaeological, that is, material and visual evidence, in order to understand how ancient culture worked and to produce a better historical analysis, ultimately.
All right, are you talking, what, about politics? Are you talking about everyday life, pop culture? What elements are you combining, or what elements are you excluding?
Well, it is the nature of the problem, as I see it, is this, that the study of classical antiquity, particularly Greece and Rome, has been structured for a very long time on the basis of the evidence of the written texts along historical outlines.
And you're going to bring some vases to all of that.
Well, people have been bringing vases to all of this for a very long time. The problem is that in the past century, the material that has accumulated, dug out by various excavations, is really amounts to a very great deal of material. And I think that the information that we're extracting out of all this material could be very much greater and put to a much greater use.
And modifies our previous understanding.
And modify our previous understanding. And one of the things that seems clear to me is that the two bodies of material, that is the written text and the archaeological evidence, are different in nature. Mm. One is the product of a certain of selection that has been made by each generation as to what should be handed down to the next.
Like libraries.
Right, and collections of texts and manuscripts. Yeah. The other, the archaeological evidence, is being recovered, and its survival is the product of very different circumstances and choices. So I won't say it's flotsam, but it is a very different kind of body of material. And it is likely to tell us about areas of society and practices which are really very different from the areas that are covered by the classical text. And when there is an overlap between the two, of course, we're much happier, much better informed. Mm-hmm. But we have to find a way, we have to find a system to extract the information that these material texts have to give us, so that the painted vases, for instance, are likely to tell us about certain areas of popular culture and popular understandings on which the written material is actually silent.
Does this make of you something of a radical in terms of your methods, if not your aims?
No, I wouldn't. I don't think so. I think that this is a direction in which we have been moving for some years, and there are types of structural analysis of one kind or another have begun being employed in classical archaeology in the late 60s, particularly in Europe, and I can see that more of it lies ahead for us.
Let's talk now, Gloria Penny, about methodology. We're about to put a 50-cent word on the table here, semiotics. I understand that this has its rewards and its perils. What do you mean by semiotics? How is it important to what you're doing as a classical archaeologist?
I think that perhaps I can approach this question better by starting with a concrete example and then working my way towards some more general principles.
Fair enough.
When I am not sure that the listeners can conjure up as we speak a very specific picture, a very precise picture of what kind of objects I work with and what kind of body of evidence they form. But these are a number of vases of different shapes on which different pictures are painted. Mm-hmm. And to begin with a concrete example, the one that has been on my mind ever since yesterday is a vase of which I received a picture in the mail. This is a small oil flask, a modest little vase, which of a type that seems to be found very often in tombs. So we think of it as a grave gift, mm-hmm. Alekhithos. And on it is painted a young woman or a girl sitting on a stool. This is a well-dressed person. She is making a wreath or a garland. To her side is a basket of a type that we know was used to contain wool for spinning. And above her is a snake.
All right, now
simply hanging on the wall.
Out of that, what kind of is meaning too conservative a word to apply here? What do you draw from all of that information?
Meaning is precisely the word to apply here. I would say that I would begin with a series of questions. Mm-hmm. Why was this particular picture placed on this particular shape? Is there a relationship between the shape, that is the function of the object, and the imagery that may be placed on it?
And what do you have to say about that?
I think that I would have to say that in this case, I do not see any obvious connection.
Uh-huh.
Then the second question that I would ask is, why was this particular representation chosen, even if we put to the side for a moment the relationship to the function of the vase?
Mm-hmm.
Why put a pretty girl there, and why is the snake in the picture?
Yeah.
I have many other pictures of pretty girls sitting with wool baskets and making wreaths,
uh-huh.
But why is the snake there?
All right, now are you about to psychologize for us here and introduce all sorts of Freudian imagery? What's going on?
No, I'm not about to do that. What I am going to say is what we have done up to this point, largely with this type of imagery. That is, one of the things that classical archaeologists will do when faced with this kind of image is to naturalize it to some extent, and at the same time apply the kind of analysis which may be broadly called historical, that is seeking to find the origin of a certain phenomenon or thing and then trace its development through time.
Right, and you stay pretty much with that methodology.
No, I don't.
You don't?
No.
All right.
So what I would normally have done had I not decided to use another way of looking at things would be to say that the artist painted what he saw of real Athens around him.
Is it important that we know who the artist is, just parenthetically?
I think that it is important to know who the artist is in terms of knowing in which ways he's likely to diverge from another contemporary artist.
All right, well, now what does this painting mean? I mean, is it can we reduce it to a sort of crude, oversimplified statement, or is that...
No, we can't. And what I'm trying to say is that we can either understand it as a picture of what the painter saw,
mm-hmm.
and essentially the choice of the painter, or one can say that this kind of image, the girl making a wreath, originates with a certain painter or a certain period because it is popular, and then trace it down.
All right, now what about the snake? We never did really get to that.
With the snake, we have several escape routes. We can say that it is the snake that is related to the function of the Lekythos because snakes are Chthonian, that is, beings which have a relationship with the other world and are appropriate to a grave. And so the juxtaposition simply refers to the funerary use of the vase.
Mm-hmm.
Or we can say that it was put there because of a whim of the painter. There is, after all, such a notion operating in the modern mind as artistic creativity, which seems to be able to take just about any license it pleases.
Mm-hmm.
And we can try to bypass that difficulty by seeing the images as natural symbols, so to speak, as something that is simply something that exists and it's always there to be represented. I think that we deny ourselves any possibility of actually acquiring somehow, even approximately, the point of view of the Athenian, a contemporary Athenian that would have seen these images.
All right, now fair enough, but at the same time, Gloria Penny, are you not also denying the transcendent meaning of an object of art? That is, you are locating it in a specific time and a specific place. And if I hear you right, you're saying to me, unless you're an Athenian in that time, of that place, you cannot appreciate what's going on in this object. Isn't the nature of art to reach across the chasm of time and communicate with us over the years? We got a contradiction here. Do we or do we not?
That is an interesting question, but it's another very large question. I would, if you will allow me, just for the time being, I would be happier saying that I am leaving the question to the side. That indeed these are objects that are considered art objects in the modern world, and in fact they're likely to be much more valued in the modern world than they were. Much more valued in the sense of being worth more money,
right.
In the modern one than they were in the ancient one, but that once you insert a certain object, once you appreciate the art in a certain object, say my little Lakithos. At the same time, you are also inserting it into your own cultural sphere, into your own system.
And that isn't germane to what you're doing.
And you understand it in your own terms. Uh-huh. It becomes part of your system.
And you want to understand it on its own terms.
And what historians such as myself are trying to do is to understand it in its own terms. And once you accept that, then I would also have to take it that each of these various elements corresponds to not to a real thing existing out there in the real world, but corresponds to a notion, a concept, an idea, which is shared by the artist and his customers and the committants.
And that's the kind of semiotic code that you're trying to crack.
That's right. Uh-huh. So what I want to know is, what does this aggregate of elements mean as they are strung together? Mm-hmm. And what does each of them mean independently? And how do I break up the picture in order to arrive at the definition of what I would consider a meaning-conveying unit, mm-hmm. a significant unit. Mm-hmm. That is, does the girl by itself constitute a unit? Does the association of girl and basket, that is the notion of girl working wool, constitute a unit? Or do I have to break the picture down into smaller units, mm-hmm. so that I will, say, decompose my basket into wool and basket and the girl into physiognomic features or dress and crown and wreath? Mm-hmm. How precisely do I go about doing that?
Gloria Ferrari teaches at Bryn Mawr College. The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. During her recent fellowship year at the center, Gloria Ferrari worked on a study of image and function in the interpretation of Greek vases. Soundings is available on cassette. Send $5 to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina. The zip is 27709. Ask for program number 511. The address again is the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. When writing, please mention the call letters of this radio station. Next week on Soundings, stagecraft in the English Renaissance and in Golden Age Spanish drama. My guests will be Graham Bradshaw of the University of St. Andrews and John J. Allen of the University of Kentucky. Soundings concludes now with Timeline, a weekly cultural retrospective. Happy anniversary to the District of Columbia, created by legislation 200 years ago this week. The first atomic bomb was detonated near Alamogordo, New Mexico, during mid-July 1945. The National Women's Hall of Fame is 11 years old as of this week. It was founded at Seneca Falls, New York, the community known as the American birthplace of women's rights. According to legend, bloomers were introduced at the first Women's Rights Convention at Seneca Falls. That was in mid-July 1848. Happy birthday this week to the French painter Edgar Degas, the mountaineer Sir Edmund Hillary, the communications theorist Marshall McLuhan, the novelists Earl Stanley Gardner and Ernest Hemingway, the English portrait painter Joshua Reynolds, the civil rights leader Nelson Mandela, and to Mary Baker Eddy, the founder of Christian Science. Until next week, this is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. Major funding for Soundings comes from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Additional support for Soundings comes from the A.J. Fletcher Foundation. Ancient History and Art, this week on Soundings. Daniel Snell of the University of Oklahoma discusses his economic and social history of the ancient Near East. Gloria Ferrari of Bryn Mawr College discusses image and function in ancient Greek vases. Money, social life, art, and popular culture in antiquity. Two conversations this week on Soundings.